my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding.
You're listening to episode 571 of Unwelcome Guests. Mother Nature Knows Best. I'm Robin Upton, and that was my attempt to distill this show's philosophical content into a title. In our second hour, we're going to hear an audio adaptation of a film about the life and death of Helen Nearing, wife of 53 years of Scott Nearing, political activist turned back to the lander. Their openness to guests and publishing about where they lived introduced many Americans to the back to the land concept. I don't know whether they were influenced by the subject of our first hour, Masanobu Fukuoka, but they share some common understanding. Now, Masanobu Fukuoka was a remarkably unconventional man, especially by Japanese standards. His determination to see what, left to herself, Mother Nature could do eventually paid dividends in the shape of his remarkable farm and special varieties of crops that he developed to grow there. I read one of his most celebrated books, One Straw Revolution, a couple of years ago. I was attracted at the time more to the philosophical than the actual technical details, so I didn't at that stage grow anything, but I'm sure that was one of the factors which has helped me to get my hands into the soil and start to grow a lot this year. Now, Charles Eisenstein, in A Scent of Humanity, suggests agriculture was one of the key stages in the human desire to control and program the world. And he likens progress since then as being adding more stories on the Tower of Babel, in which case the Green Revolution is really up the ante. Now, in the post-peak oil world, with diminished soil quality and a lot of plant strains become dependent on the addition of oil-based chemicals, you see what a short-sighted plan that was. Now, Fukuoka developed his techniques and theories before any awareness of peak oil, just inspired by looking at nature. And this is really one of the things that appeals to me. The number of different ways and the number of different topics that we have on the show which seem to be characterizing a post-peak oil world of peaceful human living in harmony with one another and with the natural world. And now let's hear the interview. This is from the Agro Innovations podcast. There's more such at agroinnovations.com. I'll link from this show's webpage. And the interview is from 2010.
Larry is a permaculture instructor, educator, and author. He has been an active student and practitioner of permaculture and natural farming for several decades, and is well known for his friendship with the great pioneer Masanobu Fukuoka. Larry Korn, welcome to the Agro Innovations podcast.
Well, it's good to be here.
Well, I wanted to talk about the life and work of Masanobu Fukuoka. Tell us about his early life and his origins and his childhood.
Well, he was born on the island of Shikoku in a small farming village. His father was fairly influential in the village. He was the mayor for part of the time. So besides growing up as a rice farmer, Mr. Fukuoka was trained as a plant pathologist. And as a young man in his 20s, he went to Yokohama to took a job at the agricultural inspection station in Yokohama, where he was inspecting fruits that were coming into Japan and going out of Japan, just to be sure that that they were clean when they came and left. So he had never been outside of his village, and he kind of partied a lot. And besides his work, he pretty much burned the candle at both ends, and at one point had to be hospitalized for just basically exhaustion. And while he was one morning after one of these, after he had gotten out of the hospital, he was sitting on a bluff overlooking the harbor, and he had an insight. And the insight had to do with nature and people's place, proper place and relationship to nature. He saw that nature was perfect, had evolved, and all the interrelationships were just right, and that the problems that were developing had to do with people using their limited intellect were thinking that they could improve upon nature, and that seemed impossible to him. And in fact, whenever people did try to improve upon nature, then there would be a side effect, and then people would deal with the side effect by applying their, again, human knowledge and intellect, and then maybe they would solve the problem or maybe not. But whatever, one thing was sure, there was another problem would develop, and then another, and then another. And so most of the work, that created a lot more work for people. And so he tried to explain this insight to others, and they, at the time, this was in the 30s, so at the time people were looking forward to a kind of a future where science would lead the way into this wonderful world. And so what he decided to do was take this understanding, go back to his farm, and apply this way of thinking to agriculture and show how it could be very useful to humanity. So he took over his father's orchard. He was the oldest son in the family, so he knew that eventually he would be coming back to farm. But he did. He came back a little sooner than expected, and he took over the farm. And so the first thing that he did was he said, well, if nature is perfect, then he's just going to sit back and let nature do it all. And the first thing he did was, well, he killed about 200 citrus trees. And then he realized that these trees had already been pruned. They'd already received the benefit of human activity, the, quote, benefit of human activity. And once that happens, people are responsible, are going to be responsible for needing to prune that tree for its entire lifetime. And by just abandoning nature in that state, it was irresponsible. And the trees, the branches crossed, and disease and insects came in, and the trees were wiped out. So you also notice that the soil in the orchard had been eroded. All the topsoil was gone. He was farming essentially on hard red clay that had very little in the way of nutrients left anymore. So he set about to improve the soil. And the first thing he did was he planted deep-rooting root crops like dandelion and daikon and burdock that have a deep taproot that would go down and start to soften up the soil. And then he added other soil builders like buckwheat and the radish family, mustard and radish. And then he started growing a ground cover of white clover, a nitrogen fixer. And over time, that really, really improved the quality of the soil in his orchard. So, you know, he didn't have a model of what he had no idea where he was going with this at the time. But just following that way of thinking, you know, instead of thinking, well, how about if I tried this and how about trying that? His way was different. He said, well, how about if I didn't do this, and how about if I didn't do that? And he peeled back one after the other all of the activities that farmers were doing at the time, thinking, well, why are we doing that? And he found that almost everything was that it was a compensation for the last thing that people had done. And then before that, so he even took on issues like, well, why are we flooding the rice fields? And why are we plowing the soil? And some basic things like that. So his farming technique turned out to be quite remarkable. He didn't plow for 45 years, and yet he cropped rice and barley in succession in the same field for all that time. Eventually, his yields matched or exceeded the neighbors' farms, where they had been using, of course, all the benefits of human technology, the tractors and agricultural chemicals and, herbicides and so forth. And so his conclusion was, well, if I'm getting yields that are comparable to the neighbors, and I'm doing a lot less work, and the soil improves every year as a result of this way of farming, then where's the benefit of all the technology that the neighbors are using? And so eventually he did prove what he had set out to prove, you know, all those years before, that there was really no benefit to all of that, and simply by going back and taking advantage of, you know, nature, the way nature is, and fitting, living within nature and fitting in within the natural cycles, well, we can live a life of abundance and do very little work. Then we'll have time to write poetry and create music and visit with friends.
So I want to ask you, Larry, about this initial mystical experience that you described that he had, mm-hmm. where he sees nature as being perfect, and then he goes and abandons his citrus orchard. And then later on he develops all these practices that you're describing as natural farming. Do you think that
yes.
this was a completion of his vision in the sense of him realizing that people are in fact a part of nature, which wasn't a part of his initial realization?
Well, the real guideline was to observe nature very closely and to see how does nature work. You know, what is it? Of course, we can't understand nature, but we can at least get a sense of the interrelationships that exist, and trying to put that back together. And then the other key ingredient in all of this is to put people back into the picture in a way that they fit in, and just as any other, you know, component of natural systems. You know, people, what he saw was that people had separated themselves from nature, that they were thinking that they were gods in a way, or they were better than nature, arrogantly thinking that they could improve on nature. And in doing that, they separated themselves, pulled them out of the whole system, as if like rules of ecology all of a sudden didn't apply to them anymore. So when you get deeper into his philosophy, it really has to do with a way of thinking, and that way of thinking is the way of thinking that, for example, sees when you see a ladybug in the fields, you right away think, oh, that's a beneficial insect, or when you see an aphid, that's a bad guy. Well, once people do that, then we have truly separated ourselves from nature, and we'll never get there. They're all part of nature. All of the insects, they're all good. And his, for example, means of insect control is to create habitat for as many different types of insects as possible. And then whenever some, insect, say, gets a little out of control in one part of the field because it has ideal conditions and a source of food and so forth, the predator's right there to keep things in balance. And this is just the way of nature. And then if we create those conditions, then people don't have to worry about insect control. But we spread the herbicides, and and clean the fields completely of habitat for insects. And once we do that, then we have to take on the job forevermore of managing the insect situation. And that, of course, is a losing battle. So it really is eventually aiming at putting people back in the right, proper, original relationship with nature. And that's why the most quoted passage in the One Star Revolution is that the ultimate goal of natural farming is not just growing crops, it's the cultivation and perfection of human beings. That's where it all starts.
Well, this is definitely fascinating, and I think for the benefit of our listeners, I'd like you to just talk more about some examples of how this way of thinking actually played out on his farm. If you could just maybe talk about some of these specific practices in more detail.
Sure. Well, he got the idea for the rotation of... First, let me say that his rice fields, he's got about an acre and a quarter of rice fields, and the orchard is about 10 acres, which is a fairly large farm by Japanese standards. Citrus, he sells all the rice and barley, and the citrus is the main cash crop. But he got the idea for the no-tillage, non-flooded field system of rice and barley growing when he passed a field. This was in like November after the rice harvest, and he had noticed that there were a few rice plants that were not harvested on the side of the field, and the stalks fell over, and he saw the rice was already sprouting up a little bit in the fall, and the straw was covering the seeds. And he said, well, gee, how come we're saving the seeds? What people do, the way to grow rice is that you save the seed over the winter, then create a starter bed in the spring and transplant it out. And he was saying, well, rice naturally falls to the ground in the autumn, so he started seeding in the autumn. He walked to the forest and he saw that the forest was never plowed. So, that the plowing, quote, plowing, occurs through the activity of the roots that are going down, massaging the soil and making channels, and the earthworms and the other insects and microbial activity. That keeps the soil loose and allows the air and the water to circulate through just fine. So we stop plowing. And the rice fields, in the spring during the monsoon, that valley where he farmed was naturally flooded. But then the flood would go away by mid-June, and so he took the water out of the fields from late June. And, then he established a ground cover of white clover all through the rice fields, and there's weeds, and other plants just come up in the rice fields. It looks completely different than the neighbors' very neat rice fields that are in rows and nothing growing besides, just the rice. So anyway, he got the idea by observing nature and imitating it. Now, another interesting thing that he developed was the way he grows vegetables. Now, he's got his wife, Ayako, that managed a small organic vegetable garden right next to the house, right out the back door, where they had a little compost pile and mixed the kitchen scraps, and it was pretty much a traditional Asian method of vegetable growing. But up in the orchard, he decided to grow vegetables like wild plants, and he grew them in the spaces between the orchard trees, mainly by mixing the seeds of lots of different vegetables and just simply tossing them out there at the right time. And this, what he wanted to do was not go through the process of, I think tomatoes would grow very well here and this is a little shaded, so I'm going to put the leafy vegetables here. He didn't want to be the one deciding. He wanted to put all of the possibilities out there for nature And then he was often surprised at where things came up and where they didn't. And he just went that way. So when you walk through his orchard, it's, you know, there's weeds and clovers and medicinal plants growing all over in the ground cover, but there's also vegetables growing pretty much everywhere. Sometimes you don't even see them, and you're just walking along and, you know, kick something and look down, and there's a squash growing down there and the weeds and so forth. A lot of these plants reseed themselves and act like perennials. So anyway, he also got that idea just from observing nature, and this is pretty much the way it happens. But there is a pretty sophisticated, it's simple, but a sophisticated technique for doing that. Some of the seeds he has to wrap in clay pellets to protect them, you know, if they need extra time to germinate or if they need to be protected from slugs or birds. He'll wrap them in a clay pellet before he tosses them out there. And he does kind of pile up bamboo here and there so that the squash and tomatoes can run over them and the vegetables eventually shade out a lot of the weeds and get a foothold in there. He doesn't trellis tomatoes. He lets them just run all over. And same with cucumbers, of course. And so then, again, the vegetable gardening pretty much runs itself. The goal, and eventually what did happen, was that the system pretty much runs itself. There are some chores and maintenance activities that need to take place, but once it's in place, it's a pretty self-sustaining system.
Okay, now you mentioned his approach to fruit trees and the fact that the fruit trees that were accustomed to being pruned then needed to be pruned in order to stay alive. But he continued to work on this problem and actually found some ways to get trees to grow naturally. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Fruit trees have been improved or been fiddled with by people for so long that it's a little difficult to understand what the natural form of these fruit trees are anymore. But he went out again back out into Zone 5, as the permaculturists call it, you know, out into the wilds of nature, and observed the way trees grow. And he saw that there were three or four main models. I mean, the tree generally grows from a central leader, and the branches grow out alternately or in whorls, and sometimes they come up as, you know, multi-stemmed from the start. But he identified the different types of trees and what their standard form originally is. And then what little pruning he did do was to keep the tree growing according to the natural form. And the advantage of that, of course, is almost no pruning. And also that the light and the air circulates through and the light reaches all of the leaves. And he talked about how, pruning, you know, the pruning methods, they come and go, and every time you look around, somebody's saying that they've got this is a better pruning method or that. But mainly they're designed to for the ease of harvesting and for commercial production. And he was more concerned with the health of his orchard ecosystem more than simply production. Although it turned out that, not surprisingly, but it turned out that his yields were comparable to the neighbors again, even using these simpler and less labor-intensive methods. So he, for example, he likes to grow trees from seed, but he admits, and these grow up into the natural form, and they're very strong, and they generally get very big. But of course, for commercial value, they're usually almost worthless. They're great in the, you know, as part of the the forest community. But he does graft certain varieties onto rootstock, but he makes sure that what he grafts on there has not had the central leader clipped. And you, if you've gotten nursery stock for trees before, they always come from the nursery with the main leader already clipped. Okay, once that happens, you've got to prune the tree forever. So he grew some of his own nursery stock, and he had a deal with the local nurseryman that what he was going to get was set aside, and the main leaders were not cut when he grafted them.
One of the things that occurs to me as I listen to you talk about this, and I think that many of the things that you describe about his philosophy and his practices, they seem consistent to me with more ancient traditions in Japanese and Asian culture, like Zen Buddhism and perhaps Shintoism and other Taoism would be another one. I wonder what your thoughts are on Fukuoka as an embodiment of some of these valuable traditions of Japanese culture before Western science really became the modus operandi.
Yeah, well, that's a good question, and there's really two parts to it. One of them would be his way of thinking, and the other would be his farming techniques. So let's do the way of thinking first. I've heard 8 or 10 times when I was with him, people would ask, so tell us, Fukuoka Sensei, you know, he was called Sensei, teacher. Is this Zen farming, or is this Taoism? It sounds a lot like Taoism. And he says, no, it's got nothing to do with religion. It's just farming. It's a timeless understanding. And if I were to call it Zen farming, then right away what you would do is take my farming and put it into your Zen file. And then that would be a way that you say, oh, I understand it because I can compartmentalize this whole thing and call it Zen. So that would be kind of playing into our need, or the need of our human intellect to try to understand things, and by doing that, gain control somehow. And he didn't want to do that. So he said, no, all I'm doing here is farming. You know, but when you're a farmer, then you're out in nature and you see all of these wonderful dramas and these things of beauty, and you hear the wind blowing through the trees and so forth, and you have, the farmer has many opportunities to break through and see God directly. And to, I don't know, to him, the religions were an unnecessary structure that people had created to try to understand. And this was really, understanding is not part of this at all. You know, if you want to set them off, you would just say, so don't you think people can understand nature? Or can understand, he says, people can't really, truly understand anything. And so forth. So, and the other thing about, is his farming going back to the way people used to farm, or is it something that for the future farming? And he said that natural farming it really doesn't matter where human society is in development or what fads are in and out. This is a timeless understanding that has always existed and will always exist. And it has nothing to do with where people are at the time. Although I'll say that a lot of these techniques in the whole system reminds me a lot of the way people practiced agriculture for several million years. You know, with the hunting and gathering and rudimentary horticulture that was the beginning of gardening. And this was going on for a long, long time. People did that for a long time until, of course, plowed field agriculture and irrigated agriculture, domestication of many plants many plants and animals came about around 12,000 years ago. And just, I know we don't want to go off into that subject, but that agriculture had certain things built into it that led to, well, basically a nightmare for humanity, and we're seeing the effects of that now. And that, incidentally, too, was technique, the plowed fields, and always needing to expand. And also, it was right about that time that people changed their way of thinking from being living within nature to somehow feeling superior, and that the nature was just there to be used by people. And that is kind of built in to the culture that developed over the past 12,000 years.
By the time that you encountered Mr. Fukuoka, he had already developed many of his most critical farming practices and philosophies. Can you tell us about how you came to meet him and the nature of your relationship through the years?
Let's see. I was always interested in Asian culture. And when I went to Berkeley in the late 60s, 66 to 70, I studied Chinese history. And after I graduated, I just decided to go to Asia for adventure, just to see what it was like there. And my first stop was Japan. And I made some friends, hitchhiked around, and I came in touch with the back-to-the-land people. You know, people had communes here and there in the countryside, and I, you know, was sort of passed from commune to commune, and I was kind of a city boy. I grew up in Los Angeles and then went to Berkeley, so this was my first time that I really was just living out in nature, and I just loved it. And I was especially attracted to the farming part. And pretty much since then, I was probably 22 or 23 at the time. Since that time, plants and soil, that's pretty much, I've done one thing or another involving plants and soil. So I heard about Fukuoka from those people. He was well respected as a thinker. And everybody knew that he had an unusual way of farming, but people hadn't been there before. And so they didn't know what the technique was. So after my first trip to Japan, I went back to Berkeley, studied soil science. And while I was there, there was one day when the professor, you know, said, "Today we're going to talk about agriculture, everybody, so put your seatbelts on." And all the soil that we had studied, it was so beautiful and interrelated, and it was just like a fantasy, wonderful world. Well, he dragged a plow through it, and he says, you know, when you plow, you break down the structure, you leave the soil open to erosion, you know, you wipe out all the plants that are there ahead of time, and you burn out the organic matter, and he went on and on. People were almost crying, you know, I was. And so somebody asked him, "Well, if plowing is so bad, how come we do it?" And he said, "Well, we just don't know any other way to do it." So when I went back to Japan and I finally decided to go visit Mr. Fukuoka, I came to his farm and there were these really amazing, his rice, it was in the summer and the rice was shorter, it was dark green, it didn't look, I'd never seen rice like that before. And he came over, walked over, he saw me standing there, and he said, "How do you like the rice? What do you think of this rice?" And I told him, "I've never seen rice like this before." And he said, "That's because the soil hasn't been plowed for more than 25 years. And it was like, oh, you know, a major bell went off in my head, because this was like the example that nobody knew existed. Nobody knew how to do it. And he did. And incidentally, in permaculture, when Bill Mollison first brought permaculture to the United States with Permaculture 1 in about 1980, he didn't mention growing grains at all in that first book because he felt so strongly about not plowing, and he didn't know how to grow grain without plowing. Then he read The One Straw Revolution, and I met him in California. We talked about it. And in permaculture too, and subsequently, the Fukuoka method has been pretty much a big part of the course of study in permaculture. So anyway, I dropped everything. I moved to, he was accepting students to work in the orchard, and he taught the technique and the philosophy. I stayed for about 2 years, and with two other people, translated the One Straw Revolution, because we felt like this was, I mean, way too important just to get, he was basically being ignored in Japan. Is too different. It was just way too different. And so the other students wanted to get it out there because they thought the philosophy was so compelling. And indeed, it is the heart of Fukuoka's whole thing, is the philosophy and the way of thinking. But I also knew that the agriculture part was really important to get that example out there. So we translated the book, and I came back to the United States, and with this very crude manuscript, I managed to show it to Wendell Berry, and he loved it and pretty much took the book under his wing and made sure it got a publisher. We worked for about a year on copy editing, and then it became kind of a big hit, even when it first came out in 1978. And since then, it's been translated into at least 25 languages. And then Fukuoka became well-known around the world, and since after that, he traveled to the United States twice, and I took him around and translated for him during those visits. And he went to Europe a few times, to India a few times, Somalia, Tanzania. He went all over the place after that, and his whole way of thinking kind of shifted because he saw that the condition of the earth was, on the large scale, was more dire than he had imagined, and his thinking went completely towards reforesting and revegetating the planet. So I actually got pretty close with him. You know, we traveled all that time together. I was a student of his for 2 years, but it was strictly definitely a sensei-deshi, you know, master-disciple relationship. I mean, his understanding, and I completely accepted that because I was, by that time, way into Asian society, and I understood that was, first of all, expected, and also because I saw how it worked, how that system worked, and so as close as we got, we were always the master and the student.
Well, I wonder if he had any insights as to how we would approach doing the reforestation. You described that he has this shift in his thinking, and did he share with you any insights into how we might approach that?
He did. And one of the main ones was surprisingly maybe not surprising, but it was similar to his the way that he grows vegetables. You know, that he doesn't want to decide. He thought, okay, just to go right to it, he wanted to mix the seeds of lots of different plants and scatter them over the edges of the desert, put them in clay pellets and seed them by airplane, scatter them all over the place, especially concentrating on areas of where there was ephemeral streams, rivers, or some kind of water to get a head, you know, just to get them started. And then let nature choose which ones are going to survive and which not. And he also had some specific techniques for, diverting water, taking advantage of what little water there is in some of these drier places. But he's always going back, you know, it always came back to the same thing. It was like, you know, how can I just provide nature the tools that it needs and then get out of the way and observe, you know, get out of the way, but still remain an interested bystander and then see what's working and copy that, replicate that. So during all those years when he was working out the system, and incidentally, he had some pretty serious failures, or what it seemed like failures to the neighbors. He had one year where he put the mulch down incorrectly, or he didn't know was incorrect at the time, but he just piled the mulch out after the rice seeding. And it smothered the rice, and the rice couldn't get through. He had an 80% crop failure, but there was about 20% of the field where the straw, instead of being piled up, had been scattered around here and there, and the rice had no trouble getting through that. So he considered that a successful year because he saw, oh, that's the answer. That's what nature wants us to do, is not pile the straw up, let it fall. And then he goes, of course, just the way it would naturally have fallen to the ground. So he didn't look at the failure and try to fix it. He looked at what worked and then tried to make that bigger and bigger, or just go that way. Eventually, it comes down to a way of thinking. I'm thinking of all of the way the other methods that he was talking about, you know, trying to reforest the hills in Greece, and well, even here in California, but they pretty much sprout from a way of thinking that needs to get corrected. People's the separation from nature and the expectation that we have to be the one. You know, if we created a problem, then it's our responsibility to fix it. That's true, but what technique are we going to use? Is it, as Einstein said, are we going to use the same way of thinking that got us into this mess in the first place? Or are we going to do something completely different? And it takes a leap of faith, you know, to kind of say, well, you know, people are used to being in control. And his technique is pretty much putting the control in someone else's hands, not someone else, but into nature's hands. And he actually, when you really get deeply into it, he, you know, he said that he thinks that he confused people for over 20 years by referring to nature as nature, because then what they were doing was filing nature into their nature file. And then he started talking more about God and about God and nature being the same thing, and about that when you look at a flower or a bee, or that what you're seeing is nature slash God, that everything in nature is not only a reflection of God, but contains God. And becomes very, actually, when you see it, it actually kind of, I don't know, at least for me, I get a kind of a physical effect. It's a tingly feeling. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. And you just say, okay, I'll leave it up to you. And so that's almost, so all of his techniques spring from that.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about, I've read online that Mr. Fukuoka developed varieties of rice that were well suited to his type of farming. Is this true, and are seeds of these varieties still available today?
Yeah, well, it is true, but I wish that they were available, but they're not, as far as I know. And that isn't the most important thing. The seeds maybe helped. And remember, he was trying to get yields because he's trying to prove that the way that you judge farms in Japan is pretty much how much rice do they yield. And he was trying to get high yields to prove the point that he could do it, you know, without the benefit of all the modern stuff. But it's not the seed so much as it's the way of thinking and the technique, and the fact that the fields, that there was a natural richness in the soil that improved every year. And there was a balance of the microorganisms in the soil and all the life there, and all of the, you know, you walk through his fields and all these insects and butterflies and things would just fly up and hop around, and the weeds and the flowers, and it's all fitting together. And that's really where the energy comes from. It's not just the kind of rice that he used.
Okay, now you've talked about the seeds wrapped in clay quite a bit. There's some great YouTube videos online of actually Mr. Fukuoka making some of these seed balls with some of his students, and even other people applying and practicing this practice. Can you talk a little bit about how these seed balls are made?
Sure. The using the seed balls, I mean, you don't, in a lot of cases, you don't need the seed balls. If you have no trouble with germination, then don't go to the trouble to make the seed balls. But if, in many cases, it's very helpful. And there's pretty basically two techniques, and one of them is, they both involve using clay, and one is wet clay and one is dried clay, the powdered clay. So with the wet clay, you simply take the seeds and mix them up. When we did it, we had a piece of plywood out there and a pile of clay, and people would walk on the clay and the seeds and mix it up with their bare feet like stomping on grapes or something. And then you take that wet clay and push it through chicken wire so that it separates into little clumps, and then roll them out with your hand, and then let them dry for a little bit. And it helps if you add some ashes, you know, from the fireplace or something, or, you know, give it, what you're doing is creating a survival little pod for it. So it can sit dormant in the, on the surface of the soil until the conditions are right. And then when it sprouts, it's got a little survival capsule there. And the other way is to stir the seeds up in a bucket, or maybe you saw the YouTube video of the cement mixer. You know, he uses this for large, you know, to do a lot of seed balls in a hurry. He'd use a cement mixer with those panels inside taken out, and so that the seeds would be spinning around, and then one person is like tossing in clay powder, and then somebody else spraying, misting it, and so the clay builds up around the seeds, and then but with the misting, then the next batch of clay sticks onto that, and so forth until the balls get to about the right size. Then dry them out and scatter them out. The seed balls, you know who's really started using seed balls a lot, and I'm delighted about it, it's a great use for it, is these people who are practicing guerrilla farming in the cities. What a great use for seed balls. You know, when you're tossing them over a chain link fence onto some bare ground in an abandoned, you know, yard or something where there's some soil out there, it's really a great use for that, guerrilla gardening. Oh, and you know what? Fukuoka's one of his things that he enjoyed is little jokes about his brand of eco-terrorism is that you fill your pockets up with the seeds of white clover and mustard and radish, and you make a tiny hole in the bottom and then go walk around on the golf courses and let the seeds kind of trickle out all around the courses. He didn't like lawns very much either, by the way.
Yeah.
Well, not many of your listeners, I don't think, do.
I don't think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Towards the end of his life, was Masanobu Fukuoka hopeful about humanity's prospects for reforming and reinventing industrial agriculture? And if so, how did he see that this change would come about?
Well, you know, he went back and forth through his whole life, being hopeful and feeling like it was impossible. And that continued throughout his life. He, you know, if you give up hope, then it really makes life a lot less pleasant. Okay, no matter how bad things seem, I don't know. He was always tried to be upbeat about it. And he didn't see really any way to get around a redistribution of the population onto smaller patches of land where work could be done more by hand. And that's what he was ultimately hoping for, where people could, you know, live, a family of four could live on a plot of land that's maybe an acre or an acre and a half, which is, you know, pretty much an old rule of thumb in Japan, that a family of four can live on about a half an acre in Japan, living within community. And as a community, he was very staunch supporter of village agriculture. He really reminds me of he's kind of a Japanese Wendell Berry in a lot of ways, you know, because it's not only, you know, he could see the spiritual side and the practical side and the importance of community. You know, that it not only nourishes people as people, but it's also very practical in terms of sharing surpluses and sharing skills and making life pleasant. So besides changing the whole mindset of the way people think, if that doesn't turn around, then that's going to be rough. But as far as the techniques in producing enough food on our limited planet, then more people going back to the land and farming in this kind of self-sufficient way within community, that was a ticket for him.
Well, I wonder what your thoughts are on his frustration in terms of getting his message across to people. It seems like his message is so strongly based on this boundary-dissolving experience that he had as a young man, and it sounds like he continued to have and perceive throughout the course of his life. And many people haven't had this type of boundary-dissolving experience and perhaps can't quite perceive the same things in the same way that he could or that other people who have had a similar experience. What are your thoughts on that, and do you think that is potentially a reason why he had this obstacle and maybe even some frustration?
During most of his life, he was pretty much a lone voice in the wilderness. He had to self-publish his first three books. He was writing articles constantly, and people generally in Japan treated him like an eccentric. That's a kind word for it. He's kind of a nut. And part of it, when I mentioned about how agriculture, you know, developed thousands of years ago in the way of thinking that people, you know, it's our right, our God-given right to have control and to use the world for our, you know, that's true in Asian societies too. This is not just a Western thing. It's the worldwide. The cultures pretty much adopted that, and so. So it's a tough sell because the culture has been teaching us for all this time that this is the proper relationship of people, that we're on top and everything else is below. Now, one thing, we haven't talked much about permaculture, but as long as we still have a minute, I'm primarily a student of Fukuoka's, and maybe it's because he kind of has an Asian style, and I was in Japan, his message really speaks to me, but it doesn't clearly speak to everybody, and especially there's this Western scientific way of thinking that it's very hard to really understand, as you said, the boundary dissolving experience, which is a nice way to put it. But then we've got permaculture. Now, the reason Fukuoka is considered so highly among permaculturists is because his farm is a perfect model of a fully developed permaculture farm. And yet he developed it in a completely different way. He started on it in the 40s, long before permaculture was even thought of. But it, you know, he got to the same place. That's not surprising, since permaculture and natural farming both use nature as their model, and it's a sort of a mimicking natural systems. So it would be actually pretty weird if they didn't come to the same place. And yet, the way of thinking is nearly opposite, frankly. That where Fukuoka is leaving the decision making to nature and is closely observing and going that way with no preconceived notion at the beginning, you know, permaculture takes a different route. You've got some area of land, and you get to know it very well by close observation, and you learn about the, you know, what the natural conditions are and the soil conditions, how the water behaves, the various sectors and so forth. You really get to know your land. You look at plant lists and everything, and then you consciously sit down at your desk and create a plan and then implement the plan, knowing, of course, that through with succession and other things that the plans that it's going to change. But one is a consciously designed system, and it's very teachable. You know, we've got these two-week, permaculture has these two-week introductory courses that teaches the fundamentals of permaculture, and, you know, it's, and to think of natural farming being taught in a two-week course is, like, defeats the whole purpose. So it's weird. So anyway, what I suggest for somebody who hasn't had that experience, I mean, entering this world through permaculture, I don't see anything wrong with that. I think permaculture is great. And it's motivated how many thousands and thousands of people worldwide to plant trees and to make better use of all of our resources and to learn to be better as people and to have better, stronger, more resilient communities. I mean, all that's great. So if Fukuoka seems like a little bit too mystical or hard to, like, just jump, take the leap, then I'd say start off with permaculture. That's just my own personal opinion. I'm not speaking for Fukuoka here. Although Fukuoka did meet Bill Mollison and Wes Jackson at the second International Permaculture Convergence, which was held in Olympia, Washington. So they did have to have a chance to meet and have conversations, and they got along really well. They're both very kind of larger-than-life characters. Anyway, so that was fun. Their meeting was fun.
Well, to conclude, I want to ask you about the work that you're doing today. What is it that you are doing to spread this message and help to build a regenerative agriculture?
Well, that's what I'm doing. I'm working to try to just support this entire movement, and because I love it. I mean, I love the work. I couldn't do anything else but work towards making, you know, the place, the world, and our communities a better place, and that means fitting in with nature in a, I mean, really truly within. So anyway, what I'm doing, I do teach permaculture classes and give workshops, and I write a few articles, and actually I've got there's still a manuscript of another book of Fukuoka's that's almost entirely about the spiritual side that I'm kind of working on as a not-so-distant project. I mean, I'm working on it now, but I don't know how long that's going to go on. I do have a website, onestrawrevolution.net, that has a lot of interesting things about Fukuoka, including just about the best biography that I've seen about him. It's not that long. It's maybe, I'd say if you printed it out, it'd be about 10 pages or so. So onestrawrevolution.net. It's got some interesting things about Fukuoka.
Larry Korn, I would like to thank you for the work that you continue to do and all the years that you have dedicated to spreading the message of Masanobu Fukuoka, and also for the work that you continue to do to get this message out, including the books and the writing and the translations and everything else. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks a lot, Frank. It's been actually, I just feel so lucky that I had the opportunity to do this. I mean, I feel like I'm the luckiest guy in the world because I happen to be, you know, at the right place at the right time. And I couldn't have walked away from it. Just couldn't.